line that, you know, policing snatches lives on the street with, you know, many of these shootings, which are seen as extrajudicial killings. But look at what we found when the judiciary is involved. There are still lives snatched away. One of the things Timothy Jones said was he thinks of Jacqueline Reynolds, who was the innocent bystander. He thinks of her every day because not only was her life lost, his was too.
And Allison Flowers, are police using this this felony murder rule to protect their own misconduct?
That is what we heard from experts about this, that it's really a red flag for misconduct when you see civilians or co-arrestees, suspects being charged with a killing that they didn't commit, but that police did. It's often a red flag for misconduct. And, you know, here in Chicago, we have a problem with that, as we see nationwide, of course. But we know that 97% of Chicago police misconduct complaints go undisciplined. And so there really is a problem of impunity where police officers face little discipline. And it's pretty easy for
Allison,
them to shift blame.
We have to leave it there. Allison Flowers and Sarah McRae will link to your piece in the Chicago Reader. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Minority Cannabis Business Association Marley Natural Expungement Day, August 27th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Village Ballroom in Portland. Expungement means to set aside arrests or convictions. Attendees that have applicable nonviolent cannabis-related crimes on their criminal record will leave the event with their expungement paperwork approved and processed by sponsored legal assistants. Again, that's the Expungement Day, August 27th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Village Ballroom, 704 Northeast Deakum Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regard to the minimum qualifications. And please answer the question, why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/AM News. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, that's kboo.fm/AM News. And thank you.
The time is 5:02 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, tenants at a Southeast Portland apartment complex march on the rental agency.
Kelly Point Park is closed after two drownings so far this summer.
And thousands of indigenous demonstrators continue gathering in North Dakota to stand against the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 22nd, 2016. I'm Natasha Delapine.
And I'm Ken Jones. Portland Parks and Recreation officials said they have temporarily closed Kelly Point Park because they're posting bigger no swimming signs there. The park is at North Marine Drive and Lombard Streets at the confluence of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers. The Bureau said two recent drownings prompted the move, and Portland Fire and Rescue is taking the next 2 days to install more warning signs. A 10-year-old girl died in the water on Sunday, while a 20-year-old man drowned August 11th. No swimming and no wading signs have been installed at Kelly Point Park since 2012, following drownings 5 years ago.
In the latest example of Portland's skyrocketing rents and displacements, renters in a 10 apartments in deep southeast Portland, the Ash Street properties, were informed that their rent was raised by $375 per month. Portland Tenants United and the Ash Street Tenants Association held a rally in front of the corporate offices of A&G Rental Management last Friday to demand they take back the rent increase and meet with the tenants to keep them housed. KBOO's Aaron Klein reports.
Alina Langford is a renter at the Ash Street properties.
I'm here because the building that I live in on 119th and Southeast Ash received a very large notice of rent increase requiring us to sign a 12-month lease. For me, it's a $375 increase per month from $825 to $1,200 a month for the next 12 months. If I don't agree to sign this lease, then I receive a no-cause eviction where I will have to terminate my tenancy on October 21st. Yeah. We, together, 8 of the 10 occupied units received this notice, and we have come together to form the Ash Street Tenants Association so we can hopefully negotiate for more fair and sustainable lease terms for the 8 tenants that received this notice.
Alina Langford has lived at the Ash Street properties with her 17-year-old daughter and 4-year-old son for over 3 years. She says she was drawn out to the 119th Street rental to afford rent and school. She recently started a new job, and she says that the timing of this huge rent increase hits her very hard.
Right now, I have a job that is working with low-income families here in the city of Portland, and the pay isn't that great. I expect to use this as a launch pad to a better career just within the next 12 months. Not being able to make these types of housing choices on my own terms means that I run the risk of my family becoming homeless. We don't have the resources right now to move or to pay $1,200 a month. It also is affecting what I'm going to do with my children, how that affects their school. I'm really involved in the community here in Portland, and it really just breaks my heart to have to consider moving away from an area in the city that I've been born and raised in. My family has lived here for generations, and we truly love it here. And it's just sad that I can't afford it anymore.
Have you looked around in the neighborhood at rental prices?
I have, and the last I looked, there was maybe 4 to 5 places. Not even in the elementary school area. There's nothing that I could find in my immediate area, but would require me to move even further out to Gresham or to Vancouver. There really isn't four apartments that I know potentially at least 8 people in my building are going to be looking for also that has a 2 bedrooms under $1,000.
And tell me about your son's plans for school.
Yeah, he's recently received a spot in the Mount Hood Community College Head Start program on 105th and Burnside, which is very convenient to my house and because I'm transit dependent. And that's just up in the air. I don't know if that's going to work out for him, and I don't have the time or the opportunity now to plan for something different. It could set him behind.
Alina Langford and the other renters at the Ash Street properties owned by A&G Rental Management are facing an impossible choice between a 45% rent increase or looking for somewhere else to live.
It's hard to come up with a plan when you're having to take every day as it comes, and it becomes very stressful. So I don't have a plan right now. I've thrown around ideas, and I'm hoping that some of these ideas can come to fruition, but I don't have the resources to plan well, unfortunately. And I think that's the biggest problem for me and all of the tenants in the building, is that 90 days is not enough time to plan for a major life change. And And when you don't have a full bank account.
What's the best case scenario, like after this today? If today was a success, what happens next for you?
That A&G will sit down and negotiate. That A&G will sit down and negotiate with us for more sustainable options, so we can stay in our home and not be faced with this in the next coming days. That would be the most ideal situation. That they rescind the notice and agree to not charge us such a large rent increase and allow us to stay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alina Langford spoke to KBOO News on Friday at a rally with Portland Tenants United and the Ash Street Tenants Association in front of the downtown building where A&G Rental Management has offices. Representatives from the office building said that A&G Rental Management were away for a company-wide picnic on the day of the rally. For KBOO News, I'm Eric Klein.
In a decision that will make it harder to remove a property's historical designation, the Oregon Supreme Court this month ruled that only the original owner can request to have the designation removed. The state of Oregon recognizes two types of historical designations of properties: local, which is administered through the state, and federal. The Oregon Supreme Court's ruling on August 4th will only affect the state-designated properties. Previously, any owner could request to have a local historical designation removed and then redevelop the property to match current zoning. There's currently almost 5,000 properties in the state of Oregon that had the local historical designation. More than 75% of those properties have changed hands, meaning the current owners of those properties would not be able to remove the historical designation, making it harder to redevelop the properties.
In an attempt to decrease staffing shortfalls, the Portland Police Department has reassigned more than 25 officers to the patrol division. According to Federal Patrol staffing standards, the Portland Police Bureau is more than 100 officers short of the required numbers. The reassignment has resulted in decreases to the Drug and Vice Division and the Gang Enforcement and Traffic Enforcement Departments. In order to meet federal staffing standards, the Portland Police Bureau will need to hire 77 new police officers per year over the next 5 years. Over the last 5 years, the police department has hired an average of only 25 new officers per year.
College tuition is rising, and the increase is squeezing the personal and family finances of students in Oregon and the rest of the U.S., according to a new report by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. KBOO's Robert Onstott reports in partnership with the Oregon News Service.
Over the last 8 years, Oregon has reduced its spending per student enrolled in higher education by more than 20%. And a report this week by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says these kinds of cuts are having an impact on students' potential for success. In addition to cutting services, public universities in the state are raising tuition. Michael Mitchell, with the center, says the high cost of college is putting a lid on what graduates can achieve post-college.
High levels of debt, even with a diploma, can prohibit newly graduated individuals from starting their own businesses and becoming entrepreneurs, which of course has implications not only for their own lives, but for the communities that they live in that would have benefited from having an additional entrepreneur.
Overall, the reduction in state funding adds up to nearly $1,400 less each year per student when adjusted for inflation. However, last year, Oregon started turning this reduction around, increasing higher education funding by 16%, more than any other state. Mitchell says that while the funding increase in the last budget cycle helped, Oregon's public colleges are still left to figure out how to address the needs of their students with fewer dollars.
As states have made these cuts to higher education, schools have had to make decisions about increasing tuition, or they've had to cut their own campus budgets, which means that they're providing fewer services, there are fewer extracurricular activities, class sizes may get larger.
The report says nationwide, funding for 2- and 4-year colleges is still $10 billion below what it was just prior to the recession. It says schools have had to raise tuition and cut faculty to find extra dollars. In Oregon, tuition has increased by nearly 38% in the last 8 years, well above the average national increase of 33%. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, this is Robert Onstott.
As of July 31st, the Oregon Department of Revenue had processed $25.5 million in the marijuana tax payments so far this year. Medical marijuana dispensaries started collecting a 25% tax on their recreational marijuana sales in January. The dispensary's second quarter returns were due August 1, 2016. Retail sales for edibles began in June, and observers had waited to see how much tax revenue was possible through the new industry. Starting October 1st, products will require more testing to screen out contaminants such as pesticides and E. coli.
Donald Trump has disappointed Oregon yet again. The Republican presidential candidate canceled a fundraiser planned for Portland on October 31st. However, officials from the campaign say Trump and his running mate, Mike Pence, might hold an event in Oregon sometime in the future. The campaign official said Trump's appearance was canceled because of the flooding in Louisiana. It's not a trend the Democrats plan to break. So far, Hillary Clinton has not announced any plans to visit Oregon.
A federal judge in Texas on Sunday blocked the Obama administration's new guidelines for restroom access for transgender students nationwide. Judge Reed O'Connor has ruled that the federal government did not comply with existing law, contradicting the Obama administration's assertion in the case. Observers hailed O'Connor's decision as a victory for social conservatives, who had claimed allowing transgender people to use public restrooms constituted as a threat to the safety of school children. A spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Justice said officials are reviewing their options. Lambda Legal, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU Tech of Texas, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights of Transgender Law Center all joined together in a statement calling the Obama administration to push back on the judge's ruling.
The Milwaukee, Wisconsin officer who fatally shot 23-year-old Sylville Smith last weekend has been identified as a fellow African-American who lived in the community and attended high school with the man he killed. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has more.
The Milwaukee officer who fatally shot 23-year-old Sylville Smith last weekend has been identified as a fellow African-American who lived in the community and attended high school with the man he killed. With racial tensions high in the city's north side, the shooting sparked some of the worst unrest in recent memory. Smith's family told reporters that Officer Dominique Hegan was acquainted with the man he killed. After the first night of arson and looting in the Sherman Park neighborhood, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett appealed for calm, saying he understood that relations between police and many in the community were strained.
But I want our residents and anybody who is watching this to understand that what that police officer encountered was an individual running who had a gun in his hand.
Community leaders say resentment has simmered for years. Nearly 40% of Milwaukee's black residents live in poverty, and Wisconsin has the highest rate of incarceration of African-American men in the country. Khalif Rainey, Sherman Park's elected city councilor, said the circumstances of the shooting weren't as important as the unaddressed realities of racial tension and inequality that have existed in the city for years.
Now, what has happened tonight may have not been right. I'm not justifying that. But no one can deny the fact that there's problems, racial problems, here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that have to be closely, not examined, but rectified. Rectify this immediately, because if you don't, this vision of downtown, all of that, you're one day away. You're one day away.
These feelings were articulated by the slain man's younger brother, Sadon Smith, who told WDJT-TV during the first night of violence that the unrest was a reaction to years of pent-up frustration at police killing citizens with apparent impunity.
It's the police. This is the madness that they spark up. This is what they encourage. This is what they provoke. This is what you get out of you taking some a loved one from someone. This is what you get. You get a lot of people that's hurt, and they can't vent the right way. They can't no longer depend on the police to be here to protect us like they say they gonna do. So this is what you get. And no, it's not gonna end today. I can't tell you it's gonna end tomorrow. I don't know when it's gonna end. But it's for y'all to start. We're not the ones that's killing us. Y'all killing us. We can't make a change if y'all don't change.
The Wisconsin Department of Justice is investigating, but has yet to release the officer's body camera footage of the shooting. The director of the ACLU's Wisconsin chapter is urging transparency from state investigators, noting that Milwaukee's police chief has already expressed conclusions drawn from a video the public has not been allowed to see. In Chicago this week, the city's police chief called for seven officers to be fired for lying about the police shooting of African-American teenager Laquan McDonald. The officers filed false reports, allegedly trying to enforce the police department's so-called code of silence. The reports were contradicted by dashcam video released by court order a year later. When the video was made public, it forced a department-wide shakeup, and the officer was charged with murder. He is out on bail and awaiting trial. Chicago activists continue to put pressure on City Hall, with reform advocates marching Wednesday calling for Mayor Rahm Emanuel to resign.
Mayor Rahm Emanuel, no matter what changes that he has made in the city, he hasn't made enough change, because the main change, he needs to step down and resign. Yes, because he was involved in a code of silence and a cover-up here in Chicago, and we are tired of it.
The head of Chicago's police union criticized the police chief's recommendation. Dean Angelo told the Associated Press that rank-and-file officers now wonder if they can get a fair shake from the police board in the face of community pressure. Nationwide, police accountability is one factor in a broader call for criminal justice reform, with advocates demanding an end to mass incarceration and for-profit policing. The U.S. Justice Department took steps this week to end the federal government's use of private prisons. U.S. Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates instructed DOJ staff not to renew contracts or reduce their scope. Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, told FSRN the move is a milestone in terms of challenging mass incarceration as national policy.
And I think it's recognition that when we're talking about depriving people of their liberty, we shouldn't be turning over that decision to a profit-making entity. That's not what we should be doing in a democracy.
After Thursday's announcement, stocks for the only two publicly traded prison contractors lost nearly 40% of their value. By Friday, they'd slightly rebounded.
The indigenous protest against construction of the Dakota Access oil pipeline continues at the Camp of the Sacred Stones. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke today with attorney Joy Brown about the latest news. They discussed the update on the treaties impacting the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's lawsuit to keep the Bakken oil pipeline out of the Missouri River. The court case is set to move forward tomorrow.
Well, over the weekend, the camp grew by, it tripled in size. There's about 3,000, maybe 3,500 people camping now. We fully expect 4,000 or 5,000 people in the next day or two. We did do a water action on the cannonball on the Missouri with canoes and kayaks and boats, continuing to pray for the water.
Yeah, that's where it's real, that's central to this whole thing. Are you a member of the Standing Rock Sioux? Are you yourself?
No, I'm a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe, which is right. Wow. Our borders touch one another. So Cheyenne River and Standing Rock borders touch one another.
Yeah,
we are all Lakota, so therefore we're all Ocheti Shakoli.
So tell us more about the why this final permit, the water permit, what would that do to your way of life?
Well, it would ruin it. I mean, the intake for Standing Rock is only less than a half a mile for the entire reservation for the water intake. So Standing Rock would be, their water would be ruined within minutes. Cheyenne River is right next door to Standing Rock, so our water intakes would be affected, as well as a large, vast amount of land, grazing land, farming land, as well as other cities along the route, like Millbridge and Gettysburg and whatnot. So this has the potential of affecting over 60 million people.
And not counting the future generations taking us up into millions, whose lives would be changed in ways they would probably never be able to understand. But if you could talk about treaties, I would have I've asked everyone that I speak to who's there about treaties and about violations of treaties and what recourse that you have to.
Well, the treaty is supreme law of the land according to the United States Constitution, and this particular piece of land falls under the 1861 Fort Laramie Treaty and under Docket 74A. Docket 74B is actually the Black Hills claim. Less well known is Docket 74A, which includes a lot of the Dakota lands that are along the Missouri. It's important to remember that Standing Rock is does claim the Cannonball Ranch. There are three railroad claims along that particular ranch where we're at right now. And so, so it's kind of like a gray area right now. But it definitely is 1861 treaty territory. And I know that Standing Rock is looking at not only the treaty law, but also Aboriginal rights to the land. I did talk to the CHPL about that.
Could you say that again, please? Just that last bit.
The Aboriginal rights to the land.
That's what we. That's the one of the core issues here. Has this just been dismissed, or how the pipeline?
Well, that's really going to be up to the courts to decide what they're going to allow in and what they're not going to allow in. So on the 24th, they start the court proceedings whether or not the enforced Standing Rock is going to go through. Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe did file for intervener status, so we can now present our own witnesses, which I am also a witness for Cheyenne River. It's important to remember this is not just a Standing Rock issue. This affects all the river tribes, which we are all Ocheti Shakoli. To remember that they had to divide us up to put us on these reservations, but in reality, we are all one tribe. It's going to be up to the courts to decide what they're going to allow in and what they're not going to allow in. And I can't speak on any of that. I'm not a legal expert.
Will it be tribal justice or will it be exclusively white justice?
I don't know. That's up to the courts to decide. I know that as, we're sovereign dependent nations, and so we have certain recourses that we can apply for. I know that Standing Rock has applied for, as written to the United Nations. And so we're, looking at all avenues. The thing is that the people are speaking and the people are camping and the people are growing in numbers. And it's not just Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota that are camped there. You have Comanche and Nez Perce and Anishinaabe and Seneca and Puyallup and Apache and Diné, and you have well over 60 to 70 different tribes that are represented there right now.
Yes,
60 or 70. So you have, and growing every day. So this really is Native America coming together and standing up for water and for treaty rights and for the protection of our children.
The month of July is the hottest month ever recorded in the U.S., and according to NASA, this year is on target to be the hottest year ever. The New York Times reported over the weekend that 14 of the 15 hottest years in the U.S. have occurred since the year 2000. And a study last year in the journal Nature Climate Change reported that 3 out of 4 extreme heat waves nationwide are linked to global warming. The study found that if nothing is done to slow climate disruption, the entire southern half of the U.S. will see more than 50 days a year above 100 degrees. Dallas, Texas might be the major metropolitan area impacted the most. The study forecasts that the Dallas area will average over 95 degrees for more than 4 months per year by the year 2100.
The Navajo Nation Indian Tribe has filed a lawsuit against the Federal Environmental Protection Agency over its failure to properly respond to the toxic spill that turned Colorado's Animas River bright orange a year ago. The spill occurred when the EPA was attempting to clean up the abandoned Gold King mine located near Durango, Colorado. The mine had filled with a toxic slew of heavy metals, including arsenic, beryllium, cadmium, mercury, and lead. Lead levels in the river after the spill were found to be 12,000 times over normal. The suit claims the federal EPA was negligent in both causing the original spill and for failing to properly clean up the river after the spill. The Animas River flows from Colorado through New Mexico and Utah. While the EPA has admitted it was responsible for the spill, it now claims the river has returned to pre-spill water quality levels. Over the last year, the EPA has spent $29 million on cleanup costs and mitigation of the toxic mine drainage that is still flowing into the river.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather's 83, mostly sunny, east of the Cascades and Hood River, bright sun and highs near 90 degrees. Today in history, in 1896, the Kerr-McGee Corporation agreed to pay the estate of the late Karen Silkwood $1.38 million, settling a 10-year-old nuclear contamination lawsuit linked to the Kerr-McGee Cimarron Fuel Fabrication Site in Oklahoma 12 years after Silkwood's death. Karen Silkwood was a nuclear technician and labor union activist killed in a suspicious car accident in 1974 as she drove to meet with a reporter from the New York Times about safety lapses at the plant. The quote of the day is from U.S. Representative Shirley Chisholm, who said, "When morality comes up against profit, it's seldom profit that loses."
Thousands of blue lakes have appeared in the southern hemisphere on the ice sheets of the East Antarctic, causing scientists to worry that the melting of this previously stable region is increasing. Research has found that over the last 10 years, the average annual number of days above freezing on the East Antarctic ice sheet has risen from less than 5 to almost 40 per year. The warm weather causes the lakes of water to pool on the ice sheets where it flows stream-like into the ocean, exponentially increasing the erosion rate of the ice sheet. Based on science developed studying the melting of Greenland's ice sheets, scientists believe there is a strong correlation between the formation of lakes on the surface of the ice and rapidly increasing ice melt rates. In related news, U.S. Navy Research Lab measurements of the Northern Hemisphere's Arctic sea ice show that the multi-year firmament ice sheet in the region has largely disappeared. Just a few decades ago, the year-round sea ice in the area was 20 to 25 feet thick. Now the sea ice melts completely during the Arctic summer.
There's some good news from Gaza. Its garment industry is picking up now as Israel eases its blockade against commercial exports. Before the 2007 war with Israel, Gaza's garment sector was a major source of wealth, but like most business in the area, has been devastated by crippling sanctions. As FSRN's Rami Almagari reports, commercial orders are coming in from Israel, which breeds new optimism for Gaza's export economy.
For the past 9 years, clothing stores in Gaza have mainly stocked imported brands. Tawfiq al-Nafar, a 67-year-old who owns a clothing store on Omar al-Mukhtar Street in the heart of Gaza City's shopping district, says stocking the racks is a challenge, with popular items selling out fast.
If local products were available all the year long, traders could pick up whatever clothes we wanted every day. For instance, this imported t-shirt has been missed from the market since before the last festival of Eid al-Fitr. I've been looking for it, but can't find it anywhere.
Israel's blockade on the Gaza Strip makes imported goods expensive, but Gaza does have a well-established garment sector of its own. It's located in Gaza's industrial north side. Mohammed Abu Shanab has run this plant since 1986 and once had 40 employees. But he says the 2007 war and Israel's blockade has caused him to scale back production. But 5 months ago, he got a big order from Israel for religious hats worn by Orthodox Jews. He says he's doing his best to fill the order.
There needs to be more ease of the border restrictions. Actually, we look forward to having daily movement of truckloads of our products into Israel.
A major problem is a checkpoint, he says, but he's optimistic that a northern border gate that recently opened for vehicles will be extended to commercial exports.
Once these restrictions are eased, I hope to be able to hire new garment workers, hopefully in the next 6 months.
Before 2007, when Gaza began to feel the economic fallout from Israeli sanctions after Hamas took power, local garment output was 17% of the territory's GDP. Taysir Alostaz, head of Gaza's Garment Employers Association, remembers the good times.
In March 2006, we had meetings with 16 Israeli companies. We signed contracts with six of them. My own company, Alostaz, was selling on the Israeli market.
Alostaz is still Gaza's largest garment firm and employs 90 workers making children's clothes. But business is much slower. Part of the reason is a stringent restriction on imports imposed by Israel. Tamer Zouedi is a government official with Gaza's industry ministry. He says it's hard to get dyes and other raw materials because of rules limiting anything with a suspected military use.
They have prevented entry of machines that manufacture leather, including dyes, under the pretext of dual use. Israel imposed a ban on sodium and some other concentrated substances, like chlorine.
The result is that many of Gaza's plants sit idle. Many garment workers only get a few shifts a month. Back in downtown Gaza, Umm Haytham al-Haddad has come shopping for her four children. She says she tries to buy local whenever she can, rather than purchase imports.
This year we found some local products that were high quality. They were the same as international products. So it all depends. If we see good locally produced products, we pick them up with confidence. Why not?
Gaza's garment merchants have a strong local demand as well as a lucrative Israeli export market. But access remains a problem. These days, only 120 of 900 plants are running. Still, there is hope that recent relaxation on exports will improve the economy. And in recent months, 35 plants have begun filling orders for Israeli markets. Getting the products out of the Gaza Strip will be slow. There used to be 6 commercial crossings. Now there is just one, making it very hard for Palestinians in Gaza to do business. Rami Al-Mighari, FSRN, Gaza.
Deadly clashes continue across the Indian-administered region of Kashmir more than 40 days after India imposed a curfew to quell unrest. Much of the disputed region, claimed by both India and Pakistan, is in open revolt following last month's killing of a young insurgent leader and social media star. FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan reports.
There is another funeral underway in Sarshali, a village south of Kashmir's administrative capital, Srinagar. Residents chanted pro-freedom slogans Thursday as the body of a young college teacher killed by Indian troops is lowered into the ground. Tariq Ahmed, a resident of Sarshali, says Indian soldiers dragged away about 2 dozen villagers off into the night. Only the body of the young teacher returned.
Troops came into the village, entered houses, and started beating whoever they saw, the young and the old. They broke everything around them. My two brothers and I were injured.
His death brings the death toll to at least 65 civilians killed in less than 6 weeks. Thousands more have been injured, with at least 400 suffering serious eye injuries due to Indian troops' controversial use of pellet guns for crowd control. Lethal force is increasingly being used on civilians. On Tuesday, paramilitary forces opened fire on a crowd blocking a road in North Kashmir, killing 4 on the spot. The government is also increasing curfew restrictions, removing exceptions for people shifting essential goods, and extending restricted hours that forces people to remain indoors round the clock. Cell phones and internet service has largely been shut down except for a single network. That's left many people cut off from anxious friends and relatives. Local political leaders have appealed to the government in New Delhi to negotiate an end to the crackdown, which is trying to suppress widespread anger over India's killing last month of a young guerrilla leader. But so far, the Indian government continues to turn up the heat, accuse its critics of sedition, and blame Pakistan for stoking the unrest in the Muslim-majority province. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
From a Saturday suicide bombing that killed 54 people, including dozens of children, at a wedding in the southern city of Gaziantep, FSRN's Noah Blazer reports from Istanbul.
Turkish authorities have linked Saturday's attack to ISIS and say the perpetrator was a child as young as 12 years old. Saturday's bombing targeted members of Turkey's 15 million-strong Kurdish community celebrating a wedding in Gaziantep near the Syrian border. The bride and groom escaped, but at least 54 people were killed. Many more were injured. Selahattin Demirtas, leader of the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, urged restraint among his party supporters who were among the victims.
I want to say to all of my fellow citizens, brothers and sisters, the best revenge against this barbarity and desperation is bringing about peace in our country.
The Turkish government accuses the HDP of links to Kurdish militants fighting ISIS across the border in Syria. The HDP denies links to armed groups and says it wants to avoid the Kurdish-ISIS confrontation from spilling over into Turkey. Now, the country finds itself mired in multiple security threats. There was last month's coup attempt that targeted Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. That overshadowed but has not calmed the bloody Kurdish insurgency in the southeast. And, as events in Gaziantep prove, multiple ISIS-linked attacks against Turkey's Kurdish population. This latest massacre in Gaziantep only reinforces anger and distrust between Kurds and their own government as the three-decade conflict smolders in Turkey's east. Noah Blazer, FSRN, Istanbul.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 5,000 Minnesota Nurses Association members at Allina Health have voted to authorize an open-ended strike. The union is trying to bargain a new labor contract, and Allina is demanding the nurses give up all their union health plans for a corporate one that costs them more and covers less. Angela Bichetti is an RN on the union's bargaining team.
We have four union M&A plans that provide the best coverage for us in the risky profession that we're in. You know, and that's very concerned that they want to take those away, and they keep saying they want to save money. And that's why, you know, we went with a proposal that we thought was a fair compromise to give up two of the plans and put a little bit more cost sharing on us. And they want to put more a higher deductible, you know, and not as much coverage onto the nurses. We need that affordable health care. We need that protection for us and our families and ultimately onto our patients as well.
The Minnesota Nurses Association says Allina seems determined to hold the labor contracts for thousands of nurses in limbo unless and until the nurses give up their MNA health insurance. The union says rather than demanding that cut, Allina should sit down for a real conversation with nurses to avoid a strike. The Chicago Teachers Union says it will strike if the schools try to impose a 7% cut on its members. Strike preparation is underway. Teachers are scheduled to return to classrooms August 29th. CTU President Karen Lewis says teachers have already given back about $2 billion in salary and benefits to the district, and there's nothing left to give. She said teachers would be returning to work without a new contract to schools hurt by severe budget cuts. The union says 500 school buildings are, quote, filthy due to bad CPS outsourcing, with contaminated pipes that may have exposed children and employees to lead poisoning, and in a climate where random gun violence and neighborhood conflicts have gripped significant parts of our city in fear.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka told Southern California Public Radio that the Labor Federation is focusing its election efforts on six key battleground states to mobilize voters.
We'll focus on Pennsylvania, Ohio, Nevada, Wisconsin, Florida, and Missouri. And in each one of those states, we have a significant voting population there. In Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, for instance, one out of five voters will live in a union household.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org. Workers Independent News is heard daily on The Rick Smith Show, live 3 to 6 p.m. coast to coast at therickSmithShow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robert Onstott, Eric Klein, and Don Zehr. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
I'm Natasha Delapine. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, hear the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9 on Alternative Radio, Ralph Nader speaks on Progressive Matters. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio welcomes Subhashani Ganeshan, curator of the New Expressive Works, and Desdemona Chiang, director of The Winter's Tale at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. At 11:30, it's Art Focus with host Andre Middleton. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.